ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the world braces for Iran's response to the American attacks on its key nuclear sites. Also, renters say they're too scared to ask landlords for repairs to their homes. And Australian scientists are getting special access to a new telescope that'll change stargazing forever.
After that, imaging astronomy is basically done. Like, there will not be a telescope that will map that wide area of sky again, because it just won't be worth it.
Iran is warning the United States of, quote, heavy consequences for entering the war on Israel's side. In a video released by the regime this afternoon, a spokesman called President Trump a gambler and said while he may have started the war, Iran will end it. As Israel and Iran continue to fire missiles at each other, Mr. Trump has now raised the idea of regime change in Tehran, despite his defence secretary earlier insisting that wasn't a goal of the White House. Gavin Coote prepared this report.
Sirens blare across Tel Aviv as the Israeli military detects fresh missiles from Iran. Both countries continue to trade fire a day after the US struck three key Iranian sites, with Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth claiming success in ending the country's nuclear ambitions.
It was powerful and it was clear. We devastated the Iranian nuclear program. But it's worth noting the operation did not target Iranian troops or the Iranian people.
The operation, codenamed Midnight Hammer, saw the US deploy seven B-2 bombers to hit multiple targets in Iran, while a US submarine stationed in the Middle East also launched more than two dozen missiles towards a nuclear site at Isfahan in central Iran. Pete Hegseth, among other top US officials, has stressed that the strikes were not aimed at changing the government in Tehran.
This mission was not and has not been about regime change. The president authorized a precision operation to neutralize the threats to our national interests posed by the Iranian nuclear program and the collective self-defense of our troops and our ally Israel.
But President Donald Trump has now suggested otherwise. Writing on his social media platform Truth Social, he says if the current Iranian regime is unable to, quote, make Iran great again, then why wouldn't there be a regime change? And while the president has claimed monumental destruction, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Dan Kane says the full extent of the damage to Iranian nuclear sites is still unclear.
Final battle damage will take some time, but initial battle damage assessments indicate that all three sites sustained extremely severe damage and destruction.
Understanding the level of damage inflicted could be crucial in determining what comes next. Iran has downplayed the impact of the US strikes, saying it had moved highly enriched uranium to other locations before the attack. Tehran has promised it will respond, but hasn't said how. At an emergency session of the UN Security Council, its ambassador to the UN, Amir Saeed Iravani, warned of a, quote, proportionate response.
The resilient and united Iranian nation has withstood deeper wounded and faced more vicious enemies, and this time, too, it will show its dignity, strength, and greatness to the world.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged a return to diplomacy, and close US allies are echoing those calls, with Britain's ambassador to the UN, Barbara Woodward, warning any further escalation would come with serious risks.
We urge Iran now to show restraint, and we urge all parties to return to the negotiating table and find a diplomatic solution which stops further escalation and brings this crisis to an end.
But there are clear fault lines within the Security Council. With both Russia and China strongly condemning the US attacks on Iran, Iran's foreign minister has travelled to Moscow, where it's understood he's due to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In Washington, there's also some criticism of President Trump's actions, which weren't approved by Congress. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine describing such a move on CBS as unconstitutional.
This is the U.S. jumping into a war of choice at Donald Trump's urging, without any compelling national security interest for the United States to act in this way, particularly without a debate and vote in Congress.
Inside Iran, there have been large protests in the capital, Tehran, with demonstrators holding signs denouncing the US attacks. Tehran has also threatened the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which is a major shipping route for oil tankers.
That report from Gavin Coote and Diana Damjanovic. As I mentioned, Iran is now warning the US there'll be heavy consequences for entering the war on Israel's side. Dr. Jessica Ganauer is a senior lecturer in international relations at Flinders University. She thinks Iran will keep shooting missiles at Israel, but it might be considering other options too.
One is that they could directly target US military assets and personnel in the region. Now, this is going to be a very risky strategy for Iran if they decide to do so, because it's very likely that if any US lives are lost, the US will really bring the full force of its military to bear in retaliatory strikes back against Iran. So what might be more likely there is we see Iran activating some of their proxy forces in the region, so maybe militias in Iraq or Syria, to attack US military bases. The second thing that they could do is to block or close the Strait of Hormuz. And this is quite serious because a significant amount of world oil and liquefied natural gas gets taken through the Strait of Hormuz. So if Iran does disrupt the supply of oil and natural gas to the world, that would be quite serious and does give Iran leverage, but it would also come potentially with costs for Iran, first of all, in raising tensions with their neighbours in the Gulf region who wouldn't like it at all, and then also with the rest of the world who, you know, would bear the costs of that.
Yes, which Middle East countries in particular would be unhappy if the strait were to be closed or perhaps obstructed?
We have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, all using the Strait of Hormuz, as well as Iraq. But particularly those Gulf countries haven't necessarily been close allies of Iran, maybe, you know, with the exception of Qatar, who feel a little bit more warmly towards Iran. But certainly countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, haven't traditionally had very close and warm relations with Iran. So it's actually very important for Iran right now, if they're trying to avoid escalation into a regional conflict, they're trying to avoid the US engaging in an all-out war against Iran, they actually need those countries in the region, such as probably most importantly Saudi Arabia, to really try to get the ear of Trump and to say to Trump, it would be much better for the whole region if you back down.
Dr. Ganauer, you mentioned the possibility of proxy forces perhaps going after the Americans in the Middle East. Could you tell us a little bit more about those proxy forces? And are there other countries that might support Iran in any retaliatory attacks?
So Iran is now quite isolated in the region. Hezbollah has been severely decimated in the last year, approximately, by Israeli forces. Similar, of course, Hamas has been very degraded. They've, you know, lost a lot of power in the last year and a half. And then with, interestingly, the changeover of regime in Syria, so the previous regime of President Assad had very close relationships with Iran and was closely backed by Iran. So Iran had leverage in the region through that previous Syrian regime, but we've also seen there recent regime change, and the current and new regime is not particularly close with Iran. So Iran doesn't have many countries left in the region who really are natural supporters, except with the possible exception of Iraq. And I think the main places where we would be likely to see attacks against US military bases, if that were to take place, would be Syria and Iraq.
If there are no retaliatory attacks on US forces or other Americans, do you think the United States will now step back, or do you think there's a chance it will continue some sort of military involvement in this war?
President Trump is likely hoping that the US will not get entangled in an ongoing tit-for-tat with Iran or in something that actually escalates into a longer drawn-out war between the US and Iran. I don't think it's possible that Iran won't try to respond in some way. And then again, as we see with tit for tat, when countries start to escalate with each other, the US will feel, if Iran now responds to the attacks on Iranian soil, the US will then again feel that they want to respond to those attacks and show that they're stronger and have, you know, stronger military force than Iran. So I actually think it's very unlikely that this will be the end of it, even though I think that's what the US administration is probably hoping.
Russia is an ally of Iran. It's condemned the US strikes, and the Iranian foreign minister is now in Moscow for talks with President Putin. What role do you see Russia playing in this war?
Iran did actually support Russia in their ongoing war against Ukraine and supplied Russia with drones and other military equipment. So I'm sure that the Iranian regime is now trying to cash in on some of those favours and trying to say to Putin, we'd now like some help in return. But because of Russia's ongoing grinding war in Ukraine, I really don't think that Russia will have much capability to help out Iran with additional military aid at this stage.
Dr. Jessica Ganauer from Flinders University. The Australian government has now made clear its support for the American decision to strike the Iranian nuclear facilities. But the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is emphasising he doesn't want the war to escalate and is again calling for dialogue and diplomacy. Around Australia, the Iranian and Jewish communities are anxiously monitoring developments, as Isabel Massali reports.
As the Iran-Israel war spirals, communities in Australia are desperately worried. Shuran Edgar is the Vice President of the Australian-Iranian Community Alliance. He says they're trying to stay strong, but that's especially difficult. Contact with loved ones in Iran is rare at the moment under an internet blackout imposed by the regime.
It would be much more easier if I'm in the middle of the conflict because I know what's happening and I've got my loved ones around me. But when you are far from your homelands and you cannot get much news from there, you cannot get in contact with them. So that makes you know, the situation much more harder for the Iranian Australian. They're far from the country.
The latest figures show nearly 3,000 people in Iran are seeking help to evacuate through Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, while in Israel that figure is about 1,300 people. Philip Zajac is the president of the Jewish Community Council of Victoria. He says it's unclear what will come next, but hopes for peace.
Virtually every Jewish person in Australia has a relative or a friend or somebody they know that's in Israel. I myself have been to Israel many, many times. I've never experienced anything like what's going on at the moment. The destruction of buildings, the loss of lives, the interference with daily lives is a state of emergency in Israel. And hopefully what the United States has done will bring a swifty conclusion to this ongoing battle. It's not good for the world to be fighting.
As world leaders responded to news of the United States strikes on Iran, Australians looking to their government yesterday were left with just a written statement. Now Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has spoken publicly.
The world has long agreed that Iran cannot be allowed to get a nuclear weapon. And we support action to prevent that, and that is what this is. The US action was directed at specific sites central to Iran's nuclear program.
He stresses Australia doesn't want escalation and a full-scale war.
We are deeply concerned about any escalation in the region, and we want to see diplomacy, dialogue and de-escalation. We've been upfront about the challenge facing the international community, that is, dealing with the threat posed by any Iranian nuclear weapons program and dealing with the risk of regional escalation. And that's why Australia called upon Iran to come to the table and abandon any nuclear weapons program. We urge Iran not to take any further action that could destabilise the region.
When asked if Australia was given prior warning of the strikes, like the UK government was, the Prime Minister responded.
The UK has been one of the countries that's been at the negotiating table with Iran for many years on its nuclear weapons program.
Just to follow up, so was your government briefed prior to the attack?
This was unilateral action taken by the United States.
Prime Minister. PM, you weren't briefed. Is that the...
This was unilateral action taken by the United States.
But Greens Foreign Affairs spokesperson David Shoebridge has condemned the government's support for the strikes.
But I'm guided by what the International Atomic Energy Agency has said. And it said repeatedly in the last few weeks that there is no evidence that Iran was on the pathway to make a nuclear bomb or had decided to make a nuclear bomb.
The opposition was quick to endorse the American strikes on Iran yesterday, and acting Shadow Foreign Minister Andrew Hastie is slamming the government's response time.
Iran cannot be allowed to get a nuclear weapon. We support action to prevent that, which is why we supported the US strikes yesterday. What yesterday demonstrated was that the Prime Minister's flat-footed. His instincts aren't great on this.
Andrew Hastie is the Federal Opposition's acting spokesman on foreign affairs. Isabel Massali with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Australian astronomers excited about a revolutionary new telescope starting its mission in South America. Well, pests, mould and leaking roofs, they're just some of the problems people renting homes can face. But a new report from ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Service, has found about 70% of renters are frightened to ask their landlords for repairs in case the request prompts a rent hike. Miles Holbrook-Walk reports.
Emma Laird works a high-pressure job as a paramedic in northern New South Wales, but she's experiencing a lot more stress on the home front where she rents.
We're hugely stressed. I've never been so stressed in my life. Stressful financially. We're awaiting another rent hike as well. So we've been told that that's going to happen, and it's something that we don't have provisions for at this time.
Having faced one rent hike at her current place, she's been told to expect another later this year.
So we've had a number of rent hikes in the last 2 years, which is a faster rate than any time that we've rented previously. We've got colleagues of ours who are paramedics in the area, and they've been really struggled to find a house.
A new report by the Australian Council of Social Service, or ACOS, and the University of New South Wales lays out the stress renters are feeling. Rent hikes are just one of them. There are also fears around reporting problems to real estate agents or landlords.
There's still this pervasive worry amongst a large section of the population renting that they can't bring up issues with their landlord without this worry about their housing hanging over them.
That's Chris Martin from UNSW, one of the authors of the report. His survey of more than 1,000 renters nationally found half of renters live in homes that need repairs, and 1 in 10 need urgent repairs for matters varying from floods and leaks to pests and mould. And 7 out of 10 are afraid of raising those very issues with their landlord. Leo Patterson-Ross is the CEO of the Tenants Union of New South Wales and says the findings are alarming.
Homes need to be a safe and healthy place. It's an important part of a really dignified life. And in 21st century Australia, we should be able to make sure that places are in good quality and in good repair. This report really shows that there is a gap in tenants' ability to make sure that their rights written in the contract that the landlord has agreed to are actually being performed.
But not everyone is as concerned by the survey findings, including Real Estate Institute of New South Wales boss Tim McKibben.
I can appreciate people may be concerned about raising issues. That's disappointing if they do feel that way. I would have thought that the vast majority of landlords would make repairs when required. The property has to be what's referred to as fit for purpose. So asking for repairs is a right that the tenant has. 7 out of 10, and I'm really struggling to understand that it would be anything like that high.
In Victoria, one solution to deal with stoushes over repairs has been made official today. Rental Dispute Resolution Victoria will handle issues related to rent increases, repairs, bonds and maintenance. Tim McKibben says as rental laws change around the country, bodies like this to expedite claims may be helpful.
Certainly in circumstances where a dispute can be mediated, that's a great outcome for everybody. You know, we would certainly support that.
Victorian Minister for Consumer Affairs Nick Stakos says an earlier pilot of Rental Dispute Resolution Victoria has already seen disputes between tenants and property owners directed away from the more serious and costly civil tribunal.
And of those 6,000 cases, around 70% were resolved by the RDRV process. And they were resolved by having dispute resolution coordinators in the first instance, ensuring that all the parties had the relevant information that they needed. And in some cases, the provision of information actually resolves the dispute.
There are hopes if those results continue, there may be similar housing-specific bodies established around the country.
Miles Holbrook-Walk reporting. Well, now a look away from the troubles on Earth to the stars. A powerful new telescope in South America is beginning its 10-year mission to capture the skies of the Southern Hemisphere in unparalleled detail. The observatory in Chile has taken nearly a decade to build, and Australian astronomers are getting priority access to its data. Luke Radford has more.
Since humans first gazed at the stars, there's been one really big challenge. To study them in detail, you need to take good pictures.
Well, it began actually in the 1990s with an astronomer called Tony Tyson, who realised that to do some of the most exciting science, you needed to be able to image large swathes of sky.
That's Professor Rachel Webster from the University of Melbourne. And the challenge she's talking about has led to the construction of the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile. It's a telescope unlike any other, and she says it's going to change the game for astronomers.
Our biggest telescopes typically only look at a very, very small patch of sky. In fact, much smaller than the area of the moon. Often they stare at those patches of sky for many hours. So to survey, for example, the entire southern sky, which is what this new telescope will do at least a couple of times a week, was an enormous ask.
The Vera C. Rubin uses the world's largest digital camera to scan the entire night sky and monitor it for changes. This is a big deal because it lets astronomers spot things that would otherwise be missed. Professor Webster is going to use it to study supermassive black holes, called quasars.
The things I'm particularly interested in are changes in the light coming from quasars. Those changes only occur very rarely, and quasars are very distributed across the sky. So with a normal telescope, if you took one image, you wouldn't have many quasars in it. So if you combine all of that, the rarity of the bright quasars on the sky and the rarity of the events that I want to look at, you need to be able to regularly survey huge swathes of sky to actually see the changes that we're looking for.
The first ultra-high definition images and video from the telescope are set to be shown on a live stream at 1 a.m. tomorrow morning. Associate Professor Edward Taylor from Swinburne University, who hasn't seen the images yet, will be getting up early to watch it.
It's utterly crazy as a concept. It's not the biggest telescope that's ever built, but it's pretty big. And what this thing's supposed to do is it's supposed to map the sky every couple of nights, the whole sky every couple of nights. To do that, you have to be fast. So this thing's about the size of a swimming pool, and it weighs about the size of an elephant. And what this thing can do is it can take an image of the sky and then move to the next bit of sky in 3 seconds, which is utterly ridiculous.
The numbers involved with this telescope boggle the mind. Australia's largest telescope, the Anglo-Australian Telescope in New South Wales, takes 2 minutes to process an image. The Vera C. Rubin does it in 2 seconds. But all that power means sorting through the data is an enormous challenge, one Australian researchers have been actively involved in overcoming.
We've had to learn, if not invent, entirely new systems for data handling and for figuring out how we can move the data from Chile to the international data centers. You know, there are telescopes that exist now that you can download the whole archive basically onto a laptop. You won't be able to fit an hour's observations onto a laptop.
Thanks to Australia's role in the project, 15 Australian universities and institutions will have priority access. Associate Professor Taylor says it will radically change the study of space.
Over the space of 10 years, it's going to build up just an outrageously deep and outrageously sensitive map of the whole sky. And after that, you know, this is a bit ridiculous, but after that, imaging astronomy is basically done. Like, there will not be a telescope that will map that wide area of sky again, because it just won't be worth it.
That's Associate Professor Edward Taylor from Swinburne Uni in Melbourne. Luke Radford, the reporter. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The United States has joined the conflict with Iran. In the early hours of Sunday morning, American warplanes dropped bombs on 3 Iranian nuclear sites. Today, international relations expert Rajan Menon on the widening conflict and what comes next. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.